Good afternoon. So last time, apparently, still doing a lecture, plus. So last time we finished up by covering RAID, this idea of what's also often known as erasure coding, that we can have a way of redundantly encoding data where we can remove parts of that data and still be able to recover the whole thing. And our classic example for RAID was we could like lose whole disks and still be able to get our data back. Then we talked about reliability in terms of consistency. That one problem we had with respect to I might lose power or something like that is that my file system would end up having an inconsistent picture, like I'd have a file, but I wouldn't have the data for the file, and I'd try to read the file and I'd get the wrong thing. We talked about ways of preventing that sort of thing from happening, the simplest one of which, as far as not having many changes to our file system design, was just to order our writes carefully, where we have this idea that we'd waste space in our file system rather than ever having pointers to things which were unallocated or wrong. That we'd do our writes in the order so that, if we lost power in the middle, what was on our storage at that time would have a picture that at least didn't give us wrong information or didn't tell us that there was free space that we had important data in that we'd want to eventually be able to find. We talked about a more systematic way of redo logging, also known as write-ahead logging, where write-ahead logging might be a more general term, but the idea is that first we write, for redo logging, we write our intention to the log. We say, this is what I'm about to do. And then we have the redo part where on recovery, where we don't know exactly which parts of the things that are logged are done, we do everything that's marked as committed in the log again. Some of those things are going to just be redundant work, but we construct our log so that that's okay. That we're, when we're doing redundant work, we're doing things that are safe to do multiple times. And some of that will be stuff that we didn't get a chance to do after we wrote our intention to do it to the log. So we'll be doing the work finally that didn't get done before we had a crash. We talked about redundancy for a different sort of use case, which is the just keeping extra copies of our data around for recovery, with the classic problem being that I accidentally delete some files and 15 minutes later I realize, wait a moment, I really wanted those. And a file system feature we can have which helps with that is this idea of snapshots, where there's an elegant way of implementing it via copy on write, that we copy only the parts of our file which change, so only the blocks which change, and we just use indirection so we can have pointers to the shared parts and separate pointers to the parts we have to copy and not actually copy that much and maintain all these different versions of, it turns out, our entire file system, ultimately having our list of inodes, which are all the files that exist and all the directories that exist, have multiple versions with indirection, allowing us to share parts of the different versions that are the same, but have and only have separate copies where we've changed some files between the two versions, where the versions would be like a snapshot of here is the files in my file system at an hour ago versus now. So any questions on things we covered last time? The question is, how trash cans or recovery recycle bins or whatever operating systems call those these days work? And the answer is no. So the idea of a recycle bin or trash can is just that we have a two-stage deletion process, where our first stage is actually we move it to a different directory, and our second stage is that we actually delete it. And this indeed was trying to solve the same problem that the snapshots I told you were trying to solve, in that people accidentally delete things that they don't want deleted, but in a different way. And with like different reasons for it to work or not work. And notably, something that snapshots do that that scheme doesn't do is that snapshots handle what if I overwrite the file with a different version. Like I edit my essay and I realize I just threw away three paragraphs I want back. Snapshots, there will be a copy with that. With our trash can scheme, well, we never deleted it, so I won't have a copy. Yeah.
So then would most OSs like that we use have both the snapshots to go back to your previous version and the recycle bin, or would they have either?
So the question is, would most have both? So snapshots are relatively rare on consumer OSs. They're not unheard of, but they're relatively rare. They're a really useful feature, and it probably would make sense to have it more. So they have some non-intuitive things that, like having old copies of your files lying around, not make sense. And there's sort of a configuration issue, which might be tricky for users, of how far back do I keep things? What do I do if I can't keep things as far back? Is it okay that sometimes you can get the stuff from a week ago and sometimes you can't because we ran out of disk space? But it's not a very common feature in these sort of consumer OSs. As for trash cans, so Unix traditionally doesn't have a concept of a trash can. You might use some Linux interface which has it, but it's sort of bolted on top and not something the OS actually knows about at the lower levels. And that was pretty common for a while. Okay, so other questions? Okay, so today's topic, we're gonna talk about distributed systems. And what I mean by distributed systems is multiple machines, which might be in different places, hence the word distributed, working together to perform a single logical task. And we'll call this a distributed system. And we're going to talk about sort of ways of providing the infrastructure we need to support writing distributed systems and the design of some distributed systems, especially ones which provide operating system-like services. So some services we know in our operating system that exist locally are like communicating between processes, like with pipes. We're going to have a distributed system equivalent of that. It works between machines. And also things like files that are shared between multiple machines and so on. We'll talk about how we can implement those. So let's first talk about, we have this idea of machines together to perform a task. We have to organize those machines in some ways. And there are two really popular models, maybe some others that we won't really talk about, but sort of two extremes. So one sort of way of organizing things is that we can have this sort of this client-server model where we have some designated, well-known machine known as the server, and it talks to multiple clients. The clients don't talk to each other directly. They just communicate with the server. That's all they know about. This is the most common model. You've seen it with like web servers. You have a client, which is running on all your devices with a web browser, that talks to a server, like some website, you know, search engine or whatever, and that runs a server that communicates separately with the clients. You don't communicate with other web browsers directly. If you want to do that, you do something with your web browser talking to the web server, and the web server talks to some other client to give that information back. And there's the other model, the other extreme, I should say, in between points, of peer-to-peer, where everyone can do everything. Everyone talks to everyone just as they need. And there's all sorts of questions on how do you know who to talk to, but we don't have some one most important thing. And there are advantages and disadvantages to both of these. Oh, so the advantage of the client-server model is it's much simpler. The big disadvantage is that, well, if there's some problem with the server, you can't do anything, whereas in the peer-to-peer model, if there's some problem with node 2 here, we're probably fine. And the big disadvantage with the peer-to-peer model is now we have a lot more complexity to figure out how to do anything. So we're mostly going to talk about this sort of client-server model. And often when we do the peer-to-peer model in practice, we'll implement it as if it's a whole bunch of client-server models stacked together in a haphazard way. So let's look at the client-server model. So here's sort of our typical usage of the client-server model. We have a client, like a web browser. It asks the server, hey, I'd like to get this web page. And the server sends back what it wants. So the client, you would say, is sometimes on. So thinking with the client-server model is that the client doesn't need to be running all the time. That's a big reason why you might choose this. Yeah, we don't want it to be the case that to use our, webmail client thing, that our phone needs to be on all the time or else our mail won't work. We want it to work from other devices. And the client sends requests to the server, and the client needs to know how to contact the server. So there needs to be some way that the client's going to be told where to get the server. We'll talk about what that looks like a bit later. And our server is going to be always on. So this is the thing which has to be running all the time. And we have to know for every client how to get to the server. So we're going to have some way of doing that. And this responds to client requests. And the server generally never actually initiates communications with the client. If the client wants to get information from the server, it needs to ask, even if it, if it's something where logically you might want it to go in the other direction. In these models, typically, like if you want to get an alert when you get an email, typically the way that's going to be implemented in this model is the client connects to the server and asks, hey, tell me if there's email sort of thing. And often in practice, we'll have sort of layers of servers. So we'll have a server which is also a client. So this classically occurs for many websites, is that you'll have your web browser which talks to a web server, but the web server doesn't actually know all the information it's sending back to you, so it talks to other servers which then talk to even more servers to figure out what's going on. But each of these pairs is that same client-server relationship. And in practice, this gets quite complicated for sort of real websites. So here's the sort of block diagram of how Wikipedia is served. So they have a server you contact, which contacts another server, which contacts a server that caches pages, and then contacts another server if there's no cached version, which contacts other caches and other servers to like keep track of how many visits there are to everything. Like there's many layers, and this is ubiquitous for a common website. But this is all client-server relationships at every step, just sort of a hierarchy. So questions about sort of client-server model? Okay. So this is in contrast to the other extreme, which is peer-to-peer, which if we say something's peer-to-peer, we mean there's no always-on server. That potentially anything could go away. And this means we have scalability. Any machine might contact any other machine. So you get, and we might have the set of machines change over time. In the client-server model, well, the clients can change, but the server can't really change because the client needs to know how to get to the server. And that shouldn't just be changing all the time. So we talked about sort of models for distributed systems. And one question is, like, why would you want to build this sort of architecture, with all these moving pieces? Like, what's the advantage of doing that? Sort of there's different things that people hope to get from doing this. And some of these are more organizational. They're not like technical issues per se, but they're better ways of organizing things. So one thing is you might have multiple owners collaborating. These could be like actually like different companies running different parts of the system, or maybe different parts of the same company running different parts of the system. That's a reason to have a distributed system, because you want different people to actually be running the separate machines. You might want to delegate the responsibility to someone else. So we think of using the cloud, like a big part of that is that someone else is responsible for this part of my system, I'm not. That's why I want to use a distributed system, even though that makes my picture of what's going on more complicated. Because at least if I'm doing this, if I'm the person in Wikipedia responsible for the stuff that renders the web pages, I don't need to care about how the caching of those web pages works. That's someone else's job. And there's also some technical reasons why people want to use these distributed systems. So one reason is actually sort of a cost efficiency reason, which is that we can build systems that handle lots and lots of load from cheap machines. So we can take 100 cheap machines together, and hopefully it's as good or hopefully better than a single machine that costs 100 times as much. You know, back in the old days of the internet, in the 90s, people would like buy $500,000 servers to run their website. And that's, you know, not so great. That's just a big investment to just get started. And if you have it split up into lots of servers, it's much easier to add incrementally. With the $500,000 server solution, this one big expensive machine, well, not only are you probably spending more than you would on the collection of smaller machines that do the same work, but if you want to, say, increase your capacity by 25%, the way you do that is you buy the $700,000 model and or something like that, which doesn't really work out so well. Another technical advantage we hope to have is redundancy, is that the hope is by using multiple machines, we can make it easy to swap out one machine for the other or tolerate one machine failing. And one way we could imagine doing this is by having two copies of the same service on different machines, like two servers we could contact. If one of those servers goes down, we can use the other one. And that hopefully makes our system more reliable than the non-distributed version. So questions about these reasons for having a distributed system? Okay. So now we talked about sort of the high-level model. Let's talk about things we need to do in actually implementing this. And one thing we need to do is we need to somehow communicate between two different machines. And I'm going to talk about probably the simplest way of thinking about that, which is this mailbox abstraction. That we're going to have, each machine has a little mailbox where they can receive messages, and we can send messages to those machines. So there's some network where if I give the network a message, this B colon hello, it knows, okay, that's for B, I'm going to get this to B. And we're going to have a queue of messages waiting to be sent at both ends. We're going to have our outgoing mailbox at machine A of things waiting to be sent to the network. And we're going to have an incoming mailbox at machine B of messages that we've gotten but we haven't looked at yet. And our idea here is that in our program, we're going to do something like, say, send to B hello. And in B, we're going to receive and we're going to get hello from that mailbox. And these send and receive operations place things in our mailbox, and the operating system moves things from the mailbox to the network when the network's ready to do that. And the network somehow knows how to get the message to B, which we'll talk a little bit about later. Okay, so this is sort of what the basic infrastructure looks like, but this abstraction doesn't provide us all the functionality we want directly. We're going to have to do a little bit of work to make the sort of communication models we wanted there. So if we think about the client-server model, one thing we wanted to do is not only do we want to receive this request from the clients, we need to send back messages to the clients, which means that we need some way of replying to the clients. And this model doesn't have that. When I receive the message, hello here, I don't know anything about where it came from. So one thing we need is a return address. So we need a return address. Another thing we might want to do is that our messages that we can put in our mailbox are going to be limited in size. You don't want to send something which is too big for that. If I'm downloading a movie, probably not one message. So we need to have sort of multi-part, split message sent in pieces, in parts. So that's something we need to support. So we're going to build this with our mailbox idea. And in fact, we're going to provide an abstraction which handles both of these issues. That handles setting up the return address, making sure we send return addresses with our messages, and tracking related messages so we can have multiple parts for a message. And the abstraction we're going to build for this is going to be called a connection. So our connections are going to be this two-way channel for messages. So rather than just say, I want to send B this, I'm going to say, I want to make a connection to B. And on B's end, B's going to say, I want to accept a new connection. And after that happens, we're just going to use this connection to send things. And our operating system is going to handle figuring out, OK, this is all part of the same connection. I've labeled it correctly on the when I put it in those mailboxes. And when you're receiving things, I'm going to figure out these things in our mailbox are for the connection you're asking me for, and therefore keep things together that are related. Okay. And note that this works in both directions. So here I send, now that I've established the connection, the application says, I want to send 2+2=? To B. And the operating system figures out how to turn that into a message over the network that includes all the information we need for this to work, which in this case includes the information that, A, it came from A, that's the return address, and here's the message. And that means when B calls receive, it knows that this is from A, it's part of this connection you just got. It's not some other unrelated message, so you don't get confused. So questions? Yes. So this is our connection abstraction. And this is what happens on the real internet. The real internet, the underlying communication is that mailbox style thing where we can just say, this machine, this data. And we add connections on top of this, including all the things you might want to do. So we have the return addresses. We also have handling errors and making sure we can, you know, split things across multiple messages. We're going to try to avoid talking about too much of that and focus on more of the operating system sort of things, the what does this look like to applications issue. But the details at the lower level take networking. They should cover that a lot. Okay. So we have this connection abstraction. And if you think about what connections are, they kind of look like two-directional pipes. So our normal pipes, you write in one end, you read in the other. Here, we can write in either end and read in the other. So it's kind of like a pipe that just works in both directions. And in POSIX, for connections, we have the same API. There's a file descriptor representing the connection, and you can read and write it like you can read and write a pipe. But it's bidirectional, unlike a pipe. Okay, so once we have a connection, it's just like using a pipe to talk to another process. So we just need to get to, well, how do we specify the connection? How do we set that up? What does that look like? And that's going to have to be different. We can't just have a, you know, connection call and then fork because, well, the thing we want to communicate with isn't on the same machine. It's not going to be our child process. We can't do what we've seen done for pipes like in our shell. So we're going to have some other way to get our file descriptor and have it represent the connection to this other machine. And to do that, one important problem we need to solve is how do I tell the operating system which other machine I want to talk to? So you need some way of referring to the machine. And we're going to refer to two different ways of doing that with this idea of names and addresses. And this is a general concept that comes up a lot in operating systems, this idea of naming. When I say about something has a name, I mean something has a logical identifier. So a good example is a file name. So notes.txt is a name of a file. It's a name that I, as a human, find meaningful. It means something to me that lets me identify a file. But when the operating system's actually accessing that file, it's not using the name. It's using other information. It's saying, oh, this is this particular inode on this particular file system. That's actually what it's doing to access the file. Similarly, if I have a variable counter in my program, when that gets turned into stuff that runs on the machine, I'm not accessing the name counter. I'm using an address, which is the information here and how to locate it, that of a particular memory location. So you have this distinction between these human logical identifiers and addresses, and this occurs more visibly in the networking space. So we're going to have these names like virginia.edu, but this is not actually the information on how to locate that machine that we're going to need to actually use to communicate with it. We're instead going to need an address, and the addresses have forms like this. We have two types of addresses, we'll talk briefly about them, IPv4 and IPv6, that identify a machine. So questions about this name address idea? Okay. So typically, if I want to contact a server, I'm going to want to use this name to contact it. But to actually send messages over the network, I need to get this IP address here. So that needs to work in some way. And there's a distributed system called the domain name system for turning names into addresses. And you can think of this as basically a database that runs across multiple machines. Multiple machines which are run by different people, because different people are responsible for different parts of the names. So Virginia, University of Virginia, is responsible for things under virginia.edu, but they're not responsible for things under google.com. We want different people to run different parts of this database. So we have this hierarchy of names that are chosen for humans, and this service lets us look up what the address corresponding to that is. So the way this works is when I connect to a network, I get information about my internet service providers, my local network's DNS server. So there's a server that I contact that's part of this distributed system. And I tell this server, hey, I'd like to look up www.cs.virginia.edu. Please tell me what the address of that is. And, well, if I'm connecting to Comcast, Comcast isn't responsible for knowing what that address is. So it's going to have to figure it out by contacting someone else. And the procedure that they've chosen for DNS is that first, they're going to contact the root server to figure out, okay, hey, root server, what's this address? And the root server, well, this is run by some central authority or set of central authorities, and they aren't responsible for Virginia.edu. So they're going to say, oh, I don't know, but these people who are responsible for .edu, they can tell you more. So it's going to say, just try the .edu DNS server instead. And the .edu DNS server is going to say, OK, I don't know, but try the Virginia server. And the Virginia server is going to say, I don't know, try the computer science department server. And then we'll finally get our answer. And in DNS, they've made the decision that I, as the end user, typically don't do all the steps of this lookup here. I just contact my ISP server, and it does that full lookup for me. And as part of that, you might say, this is awfully time-consuming. We have a trick here, which is that, well, the EDU server, it doesn't change very much. So we're going to cache that address. And only every once in a while, like every few days, are we going to check for a new version of it. So most of the time, we'll skip this first step of contacting the root server, and we'll just contact the EDU server. Maybe we can even skip that step because we've seen virginia.edu recently. Remember that. So we do caching here, which means that most of the time, my ISP's DNS server doesn't do all these steps. But sometimes it might need to. So questions about how this works? Yeah.
So is the reason that we don't, that like the root doesn't do the EDU and the Virginia, like the reason why it's not like strong like this, because then you wouldn't be able to cache?
So the question is the reason that we have all these steps because you wouldn't be able to cache? That it certainly makes it easier to cache. You could imagine getting back information saying, it's this address, and by the way, contact these people if you have .edu later. So you could do it that way. Probably the bigger reason why we don't just have root contact edu directly is that the root DNS and edu DNS server get a lot of requests, a very, very lot. And we'd like to not have them get overloaded. And so that's probably the main reason it's designed this way, is that not having them do extra work of contacting other servers like means that they, you know, that they can handle more requests with the same hardware. You know, and I would assume the root servers get like, you know, are on the order of like over a gigabyte per second or something like that of traffic. Sometimes. Okay, so questions? Other questions? Okay, so these are that's DNS. So we look up this address, which I've shown you as this numbers with dots. So what is that? So we'll talk about IP version 4 addresses. IP version 4 addresses are just 32-bit numbers. We just write them in this funny way. We write 4 8-bit numbers separated by a dot. But when we send this over the network, it actually just gets turned into one 32-bit number. And that's what's sent over the network. And these addresses are divvied up among organizations such that they get blocks of these IP addresses. So for example, UVA has everything from 128.148.0.0 to 128.255.255. That whole range of numbers is UVA's. UVA gets to choose how to assign those to different people in UVA. And Google has these bunch of ranges. They're just divided up that way by a central authority, and hopefully everyone agrees on who has which addresses. And once we've divided them up, since everyone has these big ranges of addresses, this makes it relatively simple to figure out where to send messages that are marked with this number. So we have these routers, these machines that connect multiple networks called a router, because they route those messages to the right network. And it just has this big table saying, this range of addresses, I want to send the message to network one, it will figure out what to do about it. You know, might be UVA, or it might be, you know, UVA, someone who knows how to contact UVA. And we'll just have a table for all possible addresses. We'll have an entry in this table. We might have an anything entry. And we'll just look at every incoming message. It will have this number on the front. We'll just look up that number in this table and send it to the correct network. And this is basically, you know, the high level of how we get messages on the internet to the right place, with the huge omitted detail of how do we maintain this table, which is a major and very long topic in networking. Okay, so questions on this idea? So we have these routing tables, messages, yeah, and that's basically what we do. And you might say, how big do these get? So sizes I've heard for the normal internet are like, if you're a big ISP, you might be getting and like maybe 150 to 300,000 entries, which is a lot, but manageable. Okay, so something to note about IPv4 is that what I showed you before implied that, well, we just have addresses for every organization. There are also some special IPv4 addresses which aren't really part of the internet, where a typical router not going to actually send them over the internet. So there's one very important class which is called the localhost, or loopback. And these are addresses which always refer to the machine I'm currently using. And it's, in fact, a range of this huge range of addresses from everything starting with 127 dot. is all localhost. So this doesn't get sent anywhere, just goes to my own machine, no matter what. There's also these ranges of addresses you'll commonly see, which are all these ones down here, which are not for use on the internet. They're for use between different machines, but they're not intended to be sent over the internet, and you shouldn't expect someone to do it. But you'll see these commonly because a very common strategy to deal with not having that many IP addresses assigned to you is to assign some from these private ranges and then convert them to normal addresses when people actually need to contact something external on the internet. But this allows you to have extra addresses that you didn't get centrally assigned to you. Yes?
What's the point of having 16.7 million addresses in the localhost?
What's the point of having 16.7 million addresses in the localhost? This is mostly historical. It is handy for testing in that if you want to, you can have multiple addresses for your machine for testing a distributed system. But it's mostly historical that it's so big. So we have these private addresses, and you'll very commonly see them, which is the main reason I mentioned it. You'll commonly look up your IP address, and you'll say, oh, it's 192.168. Yeah, that's an IP address that only works on your local network. It has to get churned into another address with what we call network address translation in order to actually access the internet. So there are these sets of private addresses here. There's lots of ranges of them, and all of them are used somewhere. And we also have this set labeled as link local addresses. So these are similar to private addresses, but the rule is that you never forward these. These are only for communication on the thing you are directly connected to, or in something like Wi-Fi, things that you can contact via radio and with one hop without going through someone else. And you might see these because all these addresses might be set up on your devices, which is why I'm mentioning them, so you know that, they don't work on the internet directly. There has to be something else going on. So the other thing that's going on is this thing known as network address translations. So we can convert many private addresses into one public address, and we have some box which figures out how to make sure that we preserve our connections as we're doing that. So it knows you're trying to contact this machine with a particular connection, and it makes sure you see that as a connection from that machine, even though it's changing the address it sends to that machine for you. Okay, so questions on this idea? Okay, so that's the four addresses. So I also showed you IP version 6 addresses. So IP version 6 has 128-bit numbers instead of 32-bit numbers. And it writes the addresses in a different way. And it has slightly different special addresses. But otherwise, it's basically the same as IPv4. It works in the same way. We still have ranges of numbers that go in our tables. And we still assign particular numbers to machines. It just has much bigger addresses, which notably means that you can stop doing this because now we can give everyone their own address. We have 128 bits. That should be enough. We shouldn't feel like we're running low. And you'll see these written in hexadecimal in 16-bit pieces separated by colons. Leading zeros will be omitted. And you'll see double colons, which just means a bunch of zeros that we didn't write because it's 128 bits that gets pretty long. And these are typically given out to users in these big blocks of seriously 2 to the 64 or 2 to the 80 addresses. So you have all the addresses you want. You'll never run out, hopefully. And like IPv4, we have some special addresses. I'm only going to show two of them. There are more, but two important ones that are similar. So there's localhost, which is all zeros and one. And there are link local addresses, which again means that it's things you're directly connected to only can use these. And they're never sent over the internet, which start with FE80. So questions on IPv6? Okay. So that's the other scheme. And both of these exist at the same time on the internet. So we have ways of identifying particular machines, but we have a problem that we run more than one thing on our machine. We can have multiple servers running on a machine. We can have a server and a client running on the machine. So the IP address isn't actually enough to know what program or what connection we want to be talking to. So when we get into our mailbox, we need more than that IP address to tell us, where do I send this message? What part connection is it a part of? And the extra information we're going to add is something known as a port number. And on the internet, we use 16-bit port numbers. You can think of this as kind of like a PO box. So we have one address with all these PO boxes, and each of your programs is assigned one or more of these PO boxes. And since these are for a particular machine, the machine can divide them up however it wants, but there's a common convention of how they're assigned. So typically, we just say that some particular service you might care about is assigned a particular port number, and we use the lower port numbers for this by convention. So for example, by convention, when you SSH into a machine that uses port number 22, we know to use that because that's just a convention someone wrote down. And that's how we know we're contacting an SSH server and not the web server that's running on the same machine. And we also have some port numbers which are allocated on demand. And the most important use of these are, well, when we contact like a web server, we need to give it a return address to send stuff back to us. And the OS will choose return addresses from this range as it needs them. Okay, so questions on port numbers. So now we've talked about sort of how to identify machines and now particular programs on machines. So we know how to communicate. But we need to know, like, what do we want to communicate? And we're going to have to talk about these things called protocols. A protocol means just an agreement on how we communicate. And there's like two big aspects we want to talk about in protocols. So one, which is mundane, but important for like an assignment where you have to implement a protocol, is the syntax. So the protocol is going to specify how our message is formatted. What does a message look like? That's part of the protocol. And the other is the semantics. Like what do I do when I get this message? What file do I change? And so on. That's also part of the protocol. And protocols are, there's agreement on how to communicate. These are things we see everywhere. We can think of this as something we do as humans. We think of like how we use, say, a telephone. That when I use a telephone, there's a particular way I expect to communicate with the other end, pick up the phone. If it's a landline, I wait for a dial tone. Otherwise, if it's a cell phone, I make sure I have bars. Then I dial, I wait for some ringing sound, and then we say hello, say hi, introduce self, and there's this convention that we have as humans about how we communicate, that we expect after, I start communicating, we say hello, we say hi, this is who I am. Just by convention, this is an agreement we've made socially about how we communicate, and similarly, we've made this agreement that I'm going to say bye before I hang up. I'm not just going to say, that's nice, and hang up the phone most of the time. So this is sort of a protocol, and we're going to do the same things with our computer programs. We're going to have some probably more precisely written down agreement on when do we say what, when do we introduce ourselves, how do we make requests, how do we say goodbye and stop our connection, and so on. And that's how we're going to actually build our distributed systems, is by carefully choosing the protocols so they let us specify all the things we want to do across the multiple machines. And there are a lot of protocols out there. And we're going to usually layer these protocols. So, for example, on the internet, I talked about connections, and the implementation of connections is an example of a protocol. That I said, I want to make a connection to you, and you said, yes, that's a protocol that's implemented on top of another protocol, which says, I want to send to X, how do I specify who I send to? That's a protocol, and you just say, how do I specify those things? So we have these layers of protocols. So IP, which stands for Internet Protocol, is the protocol they use on the internet to implement that mailbox model. It knows how do I specify what machine I'm sending to, how do I specify what the messages are. That's part of IP. And on top of that, we have other protocols. So one is called TCP, or the Transmission Control Protocol, which builds connections on top of that, where we just have a convention about what mailbox messages do we send to make up a connection. You know, this is where port numbers are added. This is where we say, who resends data if it's missing? How do we confirm that we don't have everything? That's all part of this protocol. And then we have protocols on top of that. So one thing you've probably seen is HTTP, which is a protocol for sending files. So part of that protocol is, how do I say what file I want? How do I know I've gotten the whole file? That's all part of that protocol. That's an agreement on what the format of everything is, what we expect servers to do if, like, they don't have the file, and so on. Okay. And there's a whole lot of protocols out there. And in this class, for our next assignment, we're going to have you implement one of these, a very historic protocol called FTP for the file transfer protocol. It's probably not the way you should send files today, but it historically was very important. So we're going to have you implement it. We chose FTP mainly because implementing it involves doing some interesting things, not because it's a great protocol that you should use. And also because implementing it doesn't involve doing things like, say, implementing SCP does, of also implementing SSH, which would be inconvenient. We're going to have you implement. So the FTP protocol, this is an example of what it looks like. So the client connects to the server. The server says, I'm ready. This is just the convention they've chosen. The client says, OK, I'm going to log in now. Gives a username and password. The server sends these messages back with these status codes saying if it's successful or not, which in the assignment we link to like a written specification which says this is what all these mean. And then we have a particular way we send commands saying, like in this case, retrieve example.txt, and have the server send that back and tell us that, yes, I found that file, here it is. So in the assignment, we'll link to the specification. And there's your VM already has installed a client that you can test with. You'll be implementing the server. So the FTP, some notable things that will contrast with other protocols we'll talk about. So one thing is FTP is stateful. That it's the sort of protocol where what we did before really matters. And you can see that here in that I log in, then I do something. And if I hadn't logged in, trying to retrieve the file would do something else. So it's stateful. The server needs to figure out what is each connection doing at any point in time. And we'll have some protocols where we won't do that, and we'll see arguments for and against tricking that. Another thing that's weird that FTP does is it uses separate connections for sending the data. So we send our commands over one connection, and we make a completely new connection to actually send our data back. This is why it makes it an interesting assignment, because you have to actually write a client and a server, basically, to send the data back. But it's a bit of a strange choice that most modern protocols for file transfer don't make, largely because it's annoying with things like network address translation. Also, you saw a common thing that FTP does that many protocols do is we have these status codes with every command to tell us if they were successful in this universal way. We also have this message like command OK, but that's not the part that's important in the protocol. The protocol specifies you look at these numbers to know if things are OK. The text is just to show the user to not let them know what's going on. But as the programmer, you just look at the number. That's all you really need to care about. And this is a very common choice that protocols make. to keep things simple to program and not, but still support making it possible to figure out what's going on. Okay, so questions so far? Okay, so that's preview of the assignment. So let's start talking about, now that we know about how we specify machines and protocols, like how we would actually use this. And for that, we need to actually be able to create our connections, our equivalents of pipes, and actually use them. And I'm going to talk about sockets. So this is what POSIX calls the things that represent connections that we have as programs, and it's a kind of file descriptor, just like a pipe is a kind of file descriptor. So it's our bidirectional pipe, which means that we're going to do some setup, and then the client can write to the server can read and get that data that was just written, and the server can write back and the client can read. So after we do some setup, it's going to look very much like pipe code, but it's bidirectional. So here I have an echo client and server, echo meaning the client sends something to the server sends the same thing back as an echo. So here's my client, where I set up the connection and I get its file descriptor. And the client gets some input from the user. Then it writes that to the socket. It checks if it failed. And while it's doing that, the server reads it. And then later on, it's going to write it back. Then the client reads back what the server writes and writes it out to the user. In this case. And we just do that in a loop. This is what we would do after we set up our socket. So questions here? Okay, so basically like pipes, but can use them in both directions. So an aside, if you look up socket code, you might not see read and write being used. You might see some other functions being used, like send or receive from, or receive message. These are other functions that POSIX has for using sockets. They do the same thing that read and write do, but they have some additional options that we do not care about in this class. But the reason that they're being used is because they're more flexible than read and write. So, this is how we use a connection, a socket, once we have it, but we need to get that set up. So what does that setup process look like? So there's two things. So one is that we have to create the file descriptor. And the way we do that is in POSIX is with a function called socket. So socket, we call it. I'll show you what the arguments look like later. And we get a file descriptor that's eventually going to represent our connection. But socket doesn't actually set up the connection. It just reserves a file descriptor and says, this is a socket of the appropriate type, but it's not actually set up for a connection yet. We have to do that later. Okay. And there's going to be actually two types of sockets we're going to care about. So one type of socket is going to be what's known as a server socket. And a server socket is not going to act like a pipe. A server socket's only purpose is going to be to get normal sockets on the server. The only thing we're going to do with the server socket is we're going to say, make a new socket with this socket. Make a new normal socket with this server socket. And on a server socket, we're going to call this function called listen. And that's what tells the operating system, this is a server socket now. I'm not going to use it to send things to someone. I'm just going to use it to get new connections. So now we have a file descriptor, but all we're going to use that file descriptor for is getting new connections after we call the POSIX listen function. And we're going to get new connections by calling the accept function. So accept's going to take our server socket, and it's going to give us a normal socket file descriptor from it that represents our connection. And for that to happen, the client's going to take its socket, and it's going to call the connect function to request that we create a new connection. So that's going to try to connect to the server socket, which is going to make the accept happen. And after both of those, the two file descriptors we got, the one we got returned from accept and the file descriptor we used with connect, are now going to be associated with each other, so reads and writes go between the two. Yes?
Can you accept multiple connections from the same server socket?
The question is, can you accept multiple connections from the same server socket? Yes. As many times as clients connect to you. Other questions? Okay, so this is what the API looks like. And what's happening underneath the hood is that when we do this setup, the operating system is recording who is involved in this connection. And the way we store that for the internet is that we store what's known as a 5-tuple. We store the protocol, the lower level protocol, usually TCP, and the two IP addresses and port numbers involved. This means that as part of this setup, we're going to end up assigning a port number to the client and to the server. So we're going to assign the port number to the server no later than when you call listen, probably earlier, we'll talk about how. And the client, when you connect, we're going to assign a port number to that so we can have this connection work. And this setup is going to create sockets which are going to store this information so we know when you call read and write on them how to send or receive messages and know that they belong to this particular socket and not some other one. Like in the example where the server accepted multiple connections, this is how we distinguish which connection does this thing I got from the network go in. We look up the connections in a table of this information about what the port numbers and IP addresses involved are and compare it to the message we just got. So we have these IP and port numbers set up, and we have a way, which I didn't show you, of explicitly setting what port number and IP address is associated with my connection at the local side. For the remote side, while I connected, that's how I specify the remote end. And this is with a function called bind. And servers are typically going to call that because they want to specify a port number so the clients know how to contact them. It's not acceptable for the server to say, I don't know what my address and port number is. Good luck figuring out how to contact me. The server's going to have a fixed one, so they'll call this function to specify that explicitly. For the clients, we won't care. We'll have to specify where the server is, but we'll let the operating system do the assignment of the local IP address and port for us, typically. So since each connection is tagged this way, we're going to have this list of connections, and you can actually look this up. So in Linux, the netstat command, this lists all the connections. So here are all the connections. You can see we have the local IP and port and remote IP and port. So this is an SSH connection to another machine because it goes to port 22. And you can see it has all those things associated with it along with the protocol. And that's how the operating system identifies the connection. And this table in the operating system, each entry also has the file descriptor and the process that owns it associated with it, so it knows how to send that information to the process when it gets it over the network. Questions on this? Okay, so with the POSIX API, what we're going to basically do in our server is going to look like this. We're going to have first this set where we create our server socket and configure it. So we're going to set its port number so we know how to contact it, and we're going to start listening for connections by calling that listen function, making it so the OS knows I'm not reading and writing, I'm just accepting new connections. Then we're going to accept a connection while a client connects to us using the port number we set up and get a connection socket. Then we're going to have some loop where we read and write things between the client and the server. And as we do this, this is how we're going to communicate things. And here I'm showing you that the client writes something, and the server reads it, then the server writes something, and the client reads it. This is a very typical pattern, but this is a protocol. I've chosen the client goes first, and the client and server takes turns. Other protocols might work differently. And eventually, after we communicate, we decide that we don't want to keep going, so we'll close our connection with the close call, just like you close a normal file descriptor. And in the case of the server, we can try again. We can just go back and accept a new connection, handle another client. So you might complain here, wait a moment, I'm only handling one connection at a time, we'll fix that later. Okay. So this is our high-level flow, and I'll go through what the code actually looks like, which I'm afraid might be a little ugly. So first I'll start with setting up for the client. So for the client, first we need to create our socket. So here I'm calling socket, then I'm going to later call connect. So here I call socket, and I need to specify some arguments. And we have three arguments here. So the first argument I'm specifying, I want an IPv4 socket. That's the way I'm going to specify who I'm communicating with. It's with IPv4, there's 32-bit number addresses. I specify stream, which means I want a byte-oriented stream of messages. The alternative is something called datagrams, which we won't talk about much. Beyond that, they're different. And I specify I want a TCP socket. That's the protocol I want the kernel, the operating system, to handle for me, and I'm going to have my own protocol on top of that. Then we need to specify where we're connecting to. So I have this argument adder I pass to connect, and I build it in this way. I need to specify the address. And here, I'm doing it the most annoying manual way. I have the 32-bit number that represents the address, and I pass it to this H2NL function, because it turns out that POSIX expects this in little endian order. In big endian order, not little endian. So I need to convert it to big endian order. H2NL converts it to big endian order, regardless of what type of machine you're on. And the same thing is true of my port number. Here I'm connecting to port number 80. I need to specify port 80 here and specify it in a big endian. The H2NS function converts a 16-bit number to big endian. So that's how I specify my address, just those two numbers. And then I pass that to the connect function using this struct. Okay, so questions so far? And this is what's in that struct. It just has the port number and the address, which is a 32-bit integer, but stored in network byte order for some reason. That is, network byte order means big endian. And there's also a similar structure for IPv6, which has a 128-bit number, which, because we don't have a 128-bit type in C, they just use an array of characters, and a port number, and some other information we mostly don't care about. So something you may say, notice here, is that we have this cast to a sock adder, and the POSIX API uses this trick of allowing us to have multiple different types of addresses. And the way we tell them apart is that they have different structs, but they all have the same first field, which tells us which type it is, because we put either AFINET or AFINET6 or something else to say which of the structs is this actually. So the operating system reads that piece of the struct to figure out what type of connection are you trying to make me open. Okay, so questions on this? So the client is specifying where to connect to. At no point am I specifying what the local address is. I'm only specifying. So if we look at our tuple here, I'm specifying with connect this part. And maybe I should make that clear. So this is the. This is the connect. If you're a client, server works differently. And this is the bind if you're a client or a server part. Okay. So we're not specifying our local address in this case. Okay. So you might say, well, it's awfully inconvenient to be using, specifying all this manually. I really wanted to use, you know, virginia.edu to specify where to connect to. So there's going to be an alternate API where we're going to call the same sorts of functions, but it's going to set up all these structs for us with the addresses. It's going to tell us what do I pass to socket and all that. And this is known as adder info. So we're going to get this struct adder info with code I'm going to show you later, and it's just going to have everything we need to pass to connect and socket. So it's going to tell us here is the three arguments you need to pass to the socket function, and here is the address you need to pass to the connect function. I've set it up for you, and we don't even have to worry about what type it is. It's going to handle both IPv4 and IPv6. So there's different structs. It's just going to give us a pointer. And we don't have to worry, is it really IPv4 or IPv6? What type is it really? We just pass that pointer to connect, and that takes care of everything. So the idea of this API is that we call this one function to get this adder info thing. And it handles looking up names in DNS. It handles figuring out whether we want to use IPv4 or IPv6, and so on. It also handles all the byte order stuff. And this is the one way we actually figure out how we set up our connections. So let me show you what a typical call to this looks like. So to use this, I'm going to have a string, which is my host name, which could be like virginia.edu. And I have a string, which is my port name, which could be a number. I can also specify the name of the service, like HTTP, if it has a well-known port number. And I'm going to ultimately pass these values to this getAdderInfo function. And it's going to look up what's that name, what's that port number, and fill in the address information for me. I also need to pass some other things, notably this hints. Here. So the hints here I'm specifying are an adder info. I'm specifying explicitly, I don't care what type of address you get me. It can be IPv4, IPv6, do anything, but I need to specify something for that. And I'm also specifying, I want a stream socket, namely TCP. I don't want something that's not TCP. So I specify that little extra information that it doesn't have from the names. And then I just call this function, and I pass a pointer to a pointer, and it fills in that pointer, and that gives me the information about where do I want to connect to, what I want to pass to connect and socket. Okay, questions? And this is how I recommend dealing with the looking up servers and sockets. There's some older APIs, which I might show you briefly, but this is cleaner and also works with both IPv4 and IPv6, so when we eventually decide that we want more IP addresses, you'll be safe. So this is what I recommend using. So some nit about this API. So one thing to note is that we have this free call here. Because it's filling in a pointer for us, it might be dynamically allocating memory, and it might, in fact, have pointers to more dynamically allocated memory, so there's a special free function which knows how to free everything safely. Also, a feature of this that we're not going to have you deal with for assignments, but I'd like you to be aware of, is that sometimes servers have multiple addresses. And getAdderInfo can return all the addresses for you. And what you're supposed to do is try to connect to each one until one works. This is one way of handling failures. I'm not going to care if you do this for the assignment, but this is something which explains why it looks the way it does. It actually returns a linked list of addresses it found. Okay, so questions? Yeah, and the way you use that is like this code does, not that you can quickly figure it out, which is that it just tries again and again until it connects and works and takes the first one which works. Okay. So if you look at documentation, you might see some older functions I just want to make you aware that they exist. So one is called get host by name, which looks up an IP address from a host name. This is what you'll commonly see in some example code. You can do this if you like on the assignment. I don't recommend it. And I will, in fact, supply sample code which uses get adder info that you can just use. Like, this is not rewrite boilerplate code. It's not interesting. Okay, so we saw doing our setup for our clients. We also need to do this for our servers. And for our servers, we want to set up not the arguments to connect, but the arguments for bind. We want to specify our local addresses. And we're going to use the same functions to do that, but we want to do things a bit differently. So one thing is that we need to specify this flag labeled as passive to say, hey, this is for a server, so set things up a little differently if you need to. And one thing a little different that we can do here is that, like in my example, I'm saying my host name is 127.0.0.1. I'm specifying my server's on the local host address. That's something I could do. I can also specify a host name of null. And that means please use all the possible addresses. And there's a special address argument which says, I want my server to be accessible in all possible addresses that my machine has. And it will use that if you pass null. It will give you the things to pass to bind that make that happen. There's also this port name argument, and you can also specify null for that, which for a server means, I don't care what port I'm on, just choose one. And it can specify that for you. And these are only valid if you're saying AI passive, because they don't make sense to say, use any IP address. If you're contacting a server, you need a specific one. But if you're making a server, you can say, use all the IP addresses. So otherwise, the call is the same. And again, I have the other setting here. So here I'm saying we set what type of IP address we want to use. So you can specify, I want IPv4, IPv6, or I don't care. And all of those would be supported. But after we make this call, we get this adder info struct, and we pass it to socket, just like we did for the client. And we pass the same sort of information, but to bind instead of connect, because we're setting up a server that where we're setting up our local address and not a client where we're setting our remote address. Okay, questions? Yes. Okay, so that's the setup. So one brief note about port numbers. So here, I'm just specifying a port number. Unix has this convention that you have to be root to use port numbers below 1024. I'm mentioning this mainly because when you're testing your assignment, you'll probably have a bad time if you try to use port numbers below 1024. Okay, so probably don't. Okay, so questions? Oops. Okay. Okay, so, and as a note, you can do this, everything we did with the get adder info, you could do manually. And one thing I mentioned is that there's this magical value for let me use all the addresses. There's just a special constant for that, and that's what get adder info is filling in for you when you pass null as the host name. There's an equivalent for IPv6. Okay, so another thing to point out here is that I showed you previously we had one connection at a time. Let's, in 1 minute, fix that to do multiple connections. And the easy solution is rather than having the arrow wrap around from close to accepting a new connection, I just start accepting a new connection right away, but I fork off a new process or create a new thread to handle each connection. And now I have a server that can handle multiple connections at the same time. So that's the easiest way to make a server that does both, that handles multiple connections at once using this API. Okay, so we'll pick up on some little nits on using sockets next time, and then start talking about some higher level distributed systems ideas. So with sockets, we're just talking about sending bytes back and forth, setting up these pipes. It turns out we're going to want sometimes maybe a more useful abstraction. So we're going to talk about one called remote procedure calls. And then we'll start talking about particular types of distributed systems, particularly file systems that are distributed across multiple machines.